This is Alexis, Ray, Sadie, and Brianna. We are going to be analyzing chapter 1 and 2 first. Okay, let's begin.
Okay, so I wanted to start off with the very beginning of chapter 1, where he talks about the sampling that happened with Yale in the class of 24. I'm not going to get into much detail about the salary thing. My bigger issue was the lack of sampling accuracy that happened there. Sampling is important. With the larger the sample, the more accurate the information is. And I feel like with the Yale, I'm going to call it a scandal because I feel like it is a scandal. So the Yale scandal, I feel like they took the people that were making the $25,000 a year and were like, we're going to use you as our poster children for Yale. Mm-hmm. Versus the people that are now, like, as he mentioned, like clerks and the under jobs.
Poor little lambs.
Yeah, the mechanics and the unemployed that are not making the $25,000 because it would look bad for them.
I think a lot of those schools do that, though. A lot of those, like, high-end schools,
they
go to the high-paying alumni
to
come back.
And then that leads to what I was writing about. Much of what we know in life is based on bad samples.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the acceptance rate of those schools, that, oh, come to this school because we give out this much financial aid, it's sampled based on all of the higher things that they have and not, like, the lower end of the spectrum.
It's really all a large competition. I mean, these large schools are just saying, oh, well, we have, you know, this grade of this or this grade of that because they want to continue that reputation that everyone thinks that they have. But I think behind all of the great statistics, quote-unquote, there's some really bad ones, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And some of the, quote-unquote, bad schools are actually better than those greater schools.
And then that comes with a lot of the dishonesty in statistics. Like, statistics are easily manipulated by biases and by, I guess, like I mentioned, taking the people that are ideal, like, people that they wanted to sample for those statistics and taking that and running with it. So, like, that leads into the whole, is there truth behind every statistic that we read? Or how do we interpret those statistics without, I guess, trying to be like, I really don't believe that any of this is true because we need statistics in life. So how do you tell the dishonesty and the, like, corruption, I guess, behind it and what's the real truth?
Well, what I thought was interesting was just while I was reading, I was really surprised at, like, how much of statistics, like, how fraudulent a lot of the statistics are, and it was interesting because you couldn't really point the finger at these people making these statistics and say you're a liar, because really, you know, their statistics were accurate in a way, but it was kind of lying by omission, and that's just kind of how they get away with these faulty statistics, like, by just, like, they kind of come up with the numbers that they want. They kind of manipulate the numbers to benefit them, which was interesting. I was surprised. I didn't know that a lot of that pretty much all of the statistics, like, a lot of statistics are done that way. That was surprising to me.
One of my favorite things that happened during this chapter was when they talked about the psychiatrist, about how he reported that that at one time everyone was neurotic.
Yeah.
And I found that interesting because, like, psychiatrists only see patients that have issues. Like, as the author mentioned, if you met a normal normal person wouldn't have met the psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
So how could he sample
everyone
if he's only seeing certain patients?
So he would say that everyone's a little...
So then right there, it's basically not factual either, because you're not meeting the whole world. You're meeting the people that come to you and basically say, hey, I'm crazy.
So. All right. I think I want to start with the mean and median thing is interesting, and that goes back to, like, Sadie's point about how it's really just about how you present your numbers and, like, what numbers you decide to show. So, like, for the examples in the books, it was, like, on page 20-something.
Right?
Yeah, 23-24 was the first introduction to that. And then, like, throughout that beginning of the chapter, it was talking about how you can use your mean to get a higher salary, or how you can use your median to get a lower salary. And it's the same as when you're like applying for loans. If you use your average income as your mean, you're going to get less, you might get less of a loan, but if you use your median as your average income, you'll get more of a loan. And
you're,
I think the numbers,
the wage of employees versus salary.
Yeah, and I think like one of the numbers for the housing one, it was like $15,000 in an income versus $3,500. Like, that is a drastic difference.
Like, it's like cherry picking data,
mm-hmm.
basically.
And then when they were like, the average wage of employees was $2,000, but then the salary of and profit of owners was $26,000.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of makes your business look
bad
because the way that you represent the data that way, you're basically saying we don't care about our employees, our owners, and the profit that we make is more important.
Yeah, it's funny because the other day I applied to some job, and when I was filling out the application, the manager who was helping me out was saying to fill in a certain section of the application so I don't get deducted a certain amount.
Yep.
And saying, okay,
yeah.
fill in this number so you
yeah.
it was like
continuously
the
have
your wage form,
a higher,
right?
yeah, a higher paycheck than you would have someone else filled out.
Yeah, like tax.
It was loans. Like,
that's
when
crazy.
I went to my bank to apply for one of my student loans, she said, always claim that you make more.
Mm-hmm.
She said 9 times out of 10, when they tell you that you may need to verify your information, you're not the one that's getting picked.
Right.
So she was like, did you get money from your parents? She was like, what kind of income do you have coming in? She's like,
okay,
let's add $200 to that. So, like, even if my median was really low, you can always lie and twist it.
So
to
weird.
Make more and to
yeah.
get more in your loan and to qualify for more.
It's like a giant game.
It is. It's weird.
So, yeah, that was, like, the first example that I, like, head-on saw about lying with statistics. Then I thought it was also interesting how they played, going back to the first chapter, I believe, how they played race into this and into statistics and the act of surveys, and how surveys can play a completely different role in statistics than just regular numbers. And statistics is more, the surveys in statistics is more of just like the word play and how you're like playing with words versus how you're playing with actual numbers.
Yeah.
So I think that's like a interesting thing that I learned about statistics through this book, was that it's not just about the numbers, but it's also about the wording.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the magazine example for me was something that I found interesting when they pulled door to door about the magazines that people were reading.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of like asking what type, they gave them the two magazines and they were like, do you read this one or this one?
Yeah.
And then they go on in the rest of the chapter to talk about like people, women are going to lie about what they read.
Yeah.
So you should have went to
yeah.
their house and like knocked on the door and said, I'm looking to buy old magazines. What type of magazines do you have for me to purchase?
Yeah.
So like, instead of people, I guess, being honest in the survey, they're trying to be like, well, this is how you should go about it to collect the data. And I thought that was interesting because it was just basically a magazine. So I didn't see the...
I remember them saying that, that you go by honesty policy. But really, you know, like, how accurate can it be if you want everybody to be honest? Like, people aren't even honest with themselves, generally, so, you know.
You should just let that record for a couple of minutes.
Okay.
You like,
enjoy
back.
The live music.
You like, and we're back recording.
Please hold.
All right, so this
Please
is podcast 2. Clearly, we're having a lot of fun in here. Who wanted to start this one?
I want to touch up on the last podcast that we recorded and talk about the relation of statistics to race and how people often... assume that one statistic is stronger than the other if a certain race is said in that specific statistic. I think, especially with all the things that's going on right now relating to race, that if one race is highlighted more than the other, then the statistic would be believed more than if they talked about the opposite race.
So I'm going to take it off the book for a second. It kind of does relate to the book because it's about race, but one of the biggest statistics that we looked at since, I guess, the beginning of freshman year has been the SAT statistic, where it's like African-Americans and Hispanics, and then that one tends to be stronger in the argument that when there isn't enough like SAT prep or when income comes to play, they generally use those two races. And then when it comes to like actual scores and things of that nature, they use the white race, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what they're trying to post there for at that moment, and that's when they decide to pull, oh, we're going to pull this race card for this topic and things like that.
Which backtracks to the whole Yale thing in the beginning of the chapter, of chapter 1 and 2.
So moving into chapter 3, there was a lot of, like, businesses featured in this chapter.
Right.
And the one thing that I thought was very interesting was the independent laboratory testing. Like, a lot of the products you see in commercials and things now, as mentioned in the book, they use their independent laboratory testing as their basis for their facts.
Again, it's, like, manipulating. Like, of course you're going to get the data that you want to come out with if you're testing yourself.
Versus the,
like,
certified testing.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, it's tested by the FDA.
Yeah.
Like, that's my biggest thing is when there's, like, food or stuff like that.
It's
that's
bizarre.
Like, endorsed by the FDA, and then there's, like, this company is over here that's like, look at this new diet pill, and then it's not endorsed by the FDA.
Yeah.
So your laboratory testing obviously doesn't match up with what the FDA
lab.
Would
like, what does that mean? Air quotes, Mr.
So
Miles. You can't hear that.
You're going to statistically put that information out there and be like, we're the best diet pill out in the market right now.
Even though it's not FDA proven.
Whereas the statistics for another would be different.
But I guess that also goes into how much money those companies make at the same time. It's because if you're not FDA, most people probably are not going to try your product, but at the same time, because you might sell your product cheaper, they're going to end up trying that product either way. And
so does that mean that they're lying for the sales? Because
it basically is lying. Again, it's like lying by omission, but it's technically not, so... You know, they can
get
away
with it. And then the smaller the sample size, there's less room for error. Like, if it was just us testing a toothpaste product, we wouldn't form as many cavities using that toothpaste as you would for 500 people using it. And then, I guess the statistic would be a little different. So maybe if only one of us got it, they'd be like, oh, 95% of the users.
So, looking into how many people were actually into the test makes a huge difference. That's a good point.
Honestly, like, it was weird to me, the independent lab study. Like, I feel like that's, like, illegal, kind of. Like, all of this is kind of illegal, right? Like, that's not, like, I don't want to use that toothpaste if they only test it in their, like, special lab.
On, like, five people.
Yeah, on, like, five people.
I feel like this book kind of, I mean, even though it was out before we actually kind of understood what statistics were, I feel like this touches base on everything that we generally know and we experience every single day, but this kind
of
gives you the, like,
a different way of
mathematical reasons behind it.
So, yeah, this is more of a factual, I guess.
Even though there's nothing factual
about
statistics, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And I feel like one of the major things that the author talked about was range. Like, if the company would use the range, would show the range that they use for the statistics, people wouldn't be so misled. But because you're like, oh, 45% of what? How many people were tested? What was your sample size? Like, what was the average? You can't tell me, oh, the average of 45% of my people, well, then I question, was there five people in there?
Yeah.
Like, what makes your product better? Or
what
you're doing better?
Yeah.
That's like the mayoral candidates the other day.
Yeah.
Like 10% of how many votes. Like, they'll tell you because they have to But if they didn't have to tell me,
that also goes to the saying, like, you don't ask, you're not going to get told.
Exactly,
so I guess this book kind of proves that people should be more curious and more
mindful.
Yeah. About the products that they're using, but two, also the stuff that, like, they're listening to in the media and going, like, back to anything, back to, like, the whole race thing. Like, is that, like, yes, that's a big issue, but how much of that racial stuff that you hear is actually true, or how much of it is just...
It's all a bunch of propaganda, really.
It's crazy, This stuff just comes up every day. I didn't even realize, like, how many statistics are thrown in the
in
average person's
face
on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Until, even the mayoral candidate.
I mean, sometimes,
like,
I find myself throwing around statistics.
Yeah.
I may think they're true, but
they're
probably not.
Yeah, they're probably not, I mean, and it's, like, weird. I think in, like, chapter 3 they were saying, like, now, like, you don't have to go around, like, fact-checking, like, your statistics now, which is going to take, like, a lot of
the
day.
Based on my own experiences.
Yeah, that fact-checking thing.
Yeah.
They did that. There was that penny graphic
on
the book where there was, like, science proves that tossed pennies come to heads 80% of the time.
Yeah.
Now, that's something we can do.
Looking at page 40, right?
Yeah. Ourselves, that you can I guess you can test it yourself, and then you can be like, oh, your statistic's wrong, or, like, your statistic's right. However...
What's your null hypothesis?
Things of the bigger nature, such like, oh, this dog food makes my dog's stomach hurt, blah, 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 or, you know, it's harder to test. So I guess you trust the statistics that are happening, because you don't want to take the time out to do it yourself, like Sadie
said. Right,
And
most people don't honestly have the time to do that.
I think since... I mean, most people are just so blinded by the media and Hollywood and all this that whatever they read now, I think they're choosing to believe, or they're thinking that, oh, well, since I read it once, it's the truth. It's like no one's really putting in the work to research something.
So with the whole vaccine thing being so big, in the book, again, they also talked about the polio vaccines a couple years ago. They tested 400 kids with the vaccination and 680 without the vaccination. So when the polio thing happened... not one of the kids that got vaccinated contracted polio, but neither did any of the controls. So none of the kids that they tested.
Really, which doesn't make any logical
sense. That even relates back to the penny thing. It's just, like, statistics are never even. Even in, like, a clear 50-50 situation, like the penny one, it's never even. Like, no matter what you do, like, you're going to flip heads 80 times and 20 times, like, tails, which is weird because, you know, it's two options, but, like, yeah, you can never, like, bank on statistics that much. Yeah.
How important do you guys think it is to ignore errors and statistics? So, like, while you're actually trying to test if a statistic is true, do you think it's important to ignore or acknowledge the fact that there might have been an error?
Quite honestly, I think an error is more of a logical reason behind something than something that we think is the truth. I mean, usually an error indicates some type of skew that should probably lead into something that has a deeper meaning to it. So I think we should be acknowledging the error, and we should be researching that error more than the kind of the general thing that we're looking at.
That's nice, yeah.
I totally agree with that, because, like, we talk a lot about human error, and then every time human error happens, everybody's like, oh, start over, try again.
Yeah.
But instead of starting over and trying again, acknowledge that it's there.
Right.
Report it when you put your statistics out. Report it when you're making your write-up. And just be like, okay, so we did this survey, or we did this project, or we did something.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the errors that happen.
Right.
Ignoring them is going to be, like, misleading people. Or they could be, like, rereading it. I'm not sure if it's this chapter or the chapter after. With the kids, with the book, was that this chapter or next chapter with the babies?
I think that was this chapter.
Chapter four.
When he talks about...
chapter three.
If kids don't walk sooner than another one.
Chapter
oh,
three.
Yeah, yeah. That was interesting.
Their development.
Yeah, but it was saying that most kids don't even, like, hit that age.
It was, like, page 43, 44,
Yeah, it was like most kids don't even learn to walk at, like, this set age, like the average or whatever.
Yeah, it says, let alone his child failed to sit up by a specific age, and the parent must conclude that his offspring is retarded.
Yeah.
And then
versus
goes on to say that other 50% of parents discover
right.
that their kids are advanced because they walked a little sooner.
Right, yeah.
I don't even know how a book like that could have been published based on
But
no
if you
facts.
Think about it, there's a lot of, when it comes to kids, there's a lot of statistics about, like, how smart your child's going to be.
And
if, like, they,
and if they
speak
formula.
Their first word by, like, their time, they're, like,
to listen
one,
to Mozart,
they're
all that
I think
stuff.
If parents notice that their child is doing something earlier in life than most children do, and that's when they kind of start to put them into, like, advanced placement things, and they start to introduce ABCs earlier and this earlier.
Which can lead
to
actual statistics
they,
that show that.
However, I don't
think
that because your kid walks a day later than mine that my kid's inferior to
right.
you.
Right,
yeah. Absolutely.
Like, maybe if it was 2 to 3 years later, then my child has something wrong. But if your kid's walking at 24 weeks and my kid's walking at 24 and a half weeks, like...
Yeah.
But again, like what Ray was saying, it's, like, the environment. So, like, if they start to see, like, some advanced, like, whatever development, then they're going to push for that more. So
but
that
also goes to, that also, like, spins completely back to race, because if you notice, like, Caucasian parents are a lot more involved with that aspect of their children than African American, Hispanic, Latino, whatever you want to identify yourself as colored, than they are. And I think, like, that's also why it brings us to the statistics of, like, how white kids do better in school, because their parents are involved in a more different way and in a different light as well. It's kind of just like, I don't know. It's interesting. That all starts from, like, the day you're born to the freaking day you die.
Yeah, you're labeled with a statistic as soon as you're born.
Yeah.
Whether it be, oh, you were born the first kid this mm-hmm. year. That makes yeah. you super special. Yeah. Like, you're being tested in school. It goes to the IQ thing, how smart you really are.
Yeah, that's that just IQ the number. One is interesting.
The IQ one, they said that they're that most four. Of the time they're given just quick and cheap, so it's hard to really tell, mm-hmm. and that they just sample intellect. So just like the SAT, right. you're not being tested on how well you are as a person, what you know as a person, right. how creative yeah. you are. Basically, you're sat in a room and like, do you know this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I go, and I think it was a quote. It said, asking those questions, it says, asking these test questions is something like what you might do in estimating the quality of corn in a field by going about and pulling off an ear here and an ear there at random.
Mm-hmm.
That, the fact that, like, you're comparing questions in an IQ test to, like, randomly picking is, like, it's weird. Like, I never would have thought about that for IQ.
But even with IQ, there's definitely error because IQ is tested in a gigantic range of questions that you may or may not know. Mm-hmm. You test an IQ kid at maybe 10 years old versus a person that's 60 years 60. Old, the knowledge is going to be different, yeah. so their IQ is going
to
be higher.
And there's right. not, like, a separate test. Like, if you're 5 to 10, yeah, take this IQ
yeah, like,
test.
Yeah, I feel like if we're going to do IQ to tell you how smart you are, do it by age of range. Don't just do it by a general broad spectrum, because
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't even know half the questions that are on there.
Yeah. So I think it's pretty clear there's a bias here as students with tests being thrown in our face, so we digress. But is there any other points that we have for this, these chapters? I think we might have wrapped it up. All right, well, on to the next podcast.
Hello. This is Ray, Sadie, and Brianna coming to you from SLA's conference room with our third podcast on How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff.
Okay, so we're going to start off on chapter 6 because we did leave off, we believe, on the last one at the end of chapter 5. So I think we're going to start off by talking about the imagery on that especially is described on page 69. This was Brianna's idea and topic, so do you want to, like, go a little bit more into that?
Yeah, so I was focusing more on, like, how they started the chapter with saying it's, like, kind of all about eye appeal and what is appealing to the eye. Mm-hmm. For example, like, more specifically with statistics, it's a lot easier to lie with imagery and then have the words say something completely different. For example, they had, like, the bag of money thing where there was, like, you know, the smaller bag of money.
Like the $30.
The bigger bag of money. But when you actually look at the picture, you would think that it's, like, twice as big and then twice as wide versus just one. I think the ratio was, like, 1 to 3 or something like that.
Yeah, it was, or 8 to 1. That's what I'm looking at right now. Or maybe it was one. Oh, right. Yeah.
They said
it was
about,
like,
69.
Yeah, there we go.
Statistic.
Yeah.
But yeah, and, like, while we were, like, planning out how we were going to make this podcast and going through notes, Ray and I were, like, talking about dramatizing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to say what you had said earlier?
What did I say again earlier?
Just like dramatizing was, like, such a big part of statistics.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, back to the eye appeal, when somebody notices such a difference in size. At least here in America, I think people tend to go with something that's larger. They use dramatizing cleverly in statistics, I think.
And that kind of, like, relates to the Gizmodo article attached to our benchmark type thing. It kind of talks about how they use visuals to stimulate, like, this false sense of, increase of production or something like that. I mean, it shows graphs, especially on this article, how they can basically say, you know, the same percentage, the same type of number, but it, with just a little bit of, like, dramatization on the one that they want to really, like, hone in on, like, on one, whatever, two sets of data. It looks like a huge, tremendous difference when looking at the visuals instead of just, like, the numbers.
So that was kind of like, we thought that chapter 6 kind of related the most to the article that was given for us for our benchmark, because it kind of talked about visuals more in the article, and chapter 6 is kind of talking about the same thing, just how like visual stimuli and like stuff like that can totally be exaggerated to, you know, kind of get the type of result that they want. Yeah. So
I think that was it about chapter 6.
Okay,
so chapter 7, one of the questions that Mr. Miles had asked us was, what is a semi-attached figure? So I realized that that question gets addressed in chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
And just like through reading the examples that were given in chapter 7, I came up with the definition that it uses similarities to prove a point, but when you cannot prove the bigger point, you
mm-hmm.
use the smaller examples. Which kind of also goes to the question that he had asked us, which is, why do advertisements rely on smaller samples? So, throughout like chapter 7, they were talking about how you can have like this big question and you can answer this big question, but it might not like be the answer that you want it to be. So you have to find something smaller to focus on. So that would be like the small sample. And the example that stuck out to me, besides, I think there was like a medical example in chapter 7 as well as a racial example, but the one when the tester had asked, white people, both white people who were like radical with, you know, blacks and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
and those who weren't, and like he came up with this theory that, you know, they're really is a difference, but he ended up focusing just on the feedback that the white people who weren't necessarily with black people gave. So that giving the outcome that, yeah, black people do get a fair chance,
mm-hmm.
yeah, because that's what those white people had said when they were asked the question, do you think black people are treated fairly in the same way in the work industry?
Right.
Of course they're going to say yeah. So, only because they want to make themselves
look
good in the Republic, you know, whatever.
Another thing that was pretty interesting to me in Chapter 7 was the kind of, like, statistics, like, relating to, like, death and, like, accidents. So that was pretty interesting because I feel like I kind of psych myself out with that type of thing, especially
mm-hmm.
with these like texting and driving commercials, all these like things. But he was talking about, you know, how they can use a figure, for example, like on the steam railroads, 4,712 people died or something. But it was talking about how like mostly all of those were like automobile like accidents, like relating to the railroads. It wasn't like passengers on board, like trains going, you know, derailing and all that type of stuff. So I think that that's interesting because, you know, again, it would be accurate to say that, yes, that many deaths happened on a railroad or whatever, like railroad, you know, transit. But it wasn't, it's not really in the way that, you know, you're perceiving it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it goes back to, like, lying by omission. But I just thought that that was interesting because I get really paranoid about, like, that type of thing, especially, like, being a teenager and, you know, with all those, like, I'm out here in these streets, so.
It says about the semi-attached figure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, before I go on to read the definition of semi-attached figure, on page 82,
mm-hmm.
It says that in America, the semi-attached figure enjoys a big boom every fourth year.
Ooh.
And so back in 1948,
mm-hmm.
Or 1942, I'm sorry, the governor thought that the salaries of teachers were too low, so he increased it.
Uh-huh.
The salaries of teachers in New York, I should say that. So the range went from $2,500 to $5,325
mm-hmm.
in that one boom. And so now they have the biggest salaries of teachers in the entire world.
That's like,
that's
interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, no, the definition of semi-attached figure is phrase seems to get used to describe a statistic, a figure, a number, which is misleading due to certain missing information. The statistic is related or attached to some situation, but does not prove what it seems to prove. The writer will often imply that the statistic proves the case, while the reader may make mistaken, but perhaps reasonable assumptions about the missing information.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. All right.
Chapter 8, I think.
Oh, are we going right into chapter 8?
Yeah, because we'll do chapter 9.
Did we do the 7? Did we do everything?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We did everything.
Yeah, so chapter 8 now.
let's see. So I wanted to start with just saying that it uses, chapter 8 kind of talks about using statistics to make yourself, whether it's yourself personally or a company that you work for, look better. And usually these are like very outlandish, which are very, very outlandish statistics. I think, so when you're using like really outlandish things to describe a statistic that you're trying to come up with, it makes them focus more on all of the detail of the statistic and not necessarily the statistic itself. So if you have a more detail-orientated statistic and a more detail-orientated process, then the person who's reading about that statistic is going to be less likely to look into that statistic because they already see all this detail. So they're like, okay, this must be, like, a complete thing. This must be the final thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then also chapter 8 kind of talks about, it kind of swings like right back to chapter 6 about having eye appeal, statements.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that chapter 8 gave a lot of hints when it related to causation and correlation. More often than not, people relate one thing to another and they say that, you know, this happened because of that, and it's just a, you know, coincidence that this happened the same year or the same time, but they have to relate.
Right.
So I think that statistics really, they use really clever ways of kind of giving details that are not necessarily noticed all the time. But
post-hoc logic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They you know, they use those large words that most people don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any more points? Institution correlation.
I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think that's it for chapter 8.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any more
podcast on chapter 9 and 10.
Hear us loud and clear. Signing off. This is Ray, Sadie, and
Rihanna.
Peace. Welcome back to podcast number 4.
Hi.
I'm Ray. That's Sadie. And
this is Rihanna. Live from the studio.
Yeah, and if you hear any screaming, please don't be alarmed because that's just our
it's
lovely
our
and warming fans.
Yeah,
cheering us on, waiting for this album to be dropped.
Hashtag definitely.
Yes. Buy it.
Okay.
It's here.
All right, so we're going to get our feet wet with Chapter 9. So one thing that was really prevalent to me in this chapter was statistically versus realistically, and actually Brianna coined that phrase. I think it's pretty awesome. But so basically the one thing that came, like that stood out to me, it was around page 104 to 105. You see them talking about the 1949 Bureau Census, Bureau of the Census. And when you think about the census, you're thinking about, you know, this kind of average for, like, humankind or whatever, like, Americans and blah, 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 like, the census, and you're thinking about something that's really accurate and something that a lot of data is based off of, like, a lot of data pulls from the census because it's kind of like this overall, like, overarching, whatever, like, accurate representation of, like, American life. But it says, basically, it was talking about how it's saying that in the magazine, in this like one paper on philanthropic living or something like that. It's philanthropic. There we go. Thank you, Ray. Yeah, I was like, that is a word. Anyways, so it says that basically the average income for the average American household was around sorry, we just have many fans coming. No, it's
okay. Okay, thank you.
Should we just record?
Yeah, let's continue recording.
Okay.
We did have a sign on the door, just a little side note.
Yeah,
no, we'll make up
it's
for all right, the lost
though.
30 seconds.
I mean,
just,
those fans get pretty crazy out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They just want to intrude.
Yeah.
We got to get better security.
So, basically what I was saying is that, like, the income of the average family was about $5,004, when actually the real number was around $3,100. And it talks about basically using this kind of, like, gets brought up again in Chapter 10, but it talks about using, like, median versus mean and how big of a difference that can make. I mean, when you think about averaging, probably the best.
No, I think it's funny. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. When they add certain statistics about certain places to make the other statistics that they mentioned more appealing,
mm-hmm.
on page 96, it talked about basically just kind of like money situations in certain states back in the 20s and the 30s, and how propaganda was all this, or how all this like trickery of propaganda was going on. And they mentioned certain things, but to make it more appealing, they said, to show we aren't cheating, we added Maryland, Delaware, and Rhode Island for good measure.
Yeah.
So I think it's funny that they kind of try and persuade us with other states that people find appealing.
Yeah. Yeah. I also found that interesting, that kind of, like, maps kind of get like, they're used to, like, misinform people a lot. I mean, on a lot of the articles that I read, I would find, you know, maps being kind of, like, the number one culprit of, like, deception. On the one article that I really looked at, it was, like, statcolumbia.edu or something. It also touches, like, how they use... they, like, kind of misinform you when using, like, maps and, like, geographics and all that type of fun stuff. All right, so what else do we need to talk about?
One thing, like, relating back to what Ray said about how they added three
mm-hmm.
states, that can, like, really make or break your stats is if you, like, add or you remove details from
mm-hmm.
what you're trying to make a statistic about. yeah, and for my article, if I can remember.
Yeah.
so I looked at five ways statistics are used to lie to you on a daily basis. So one that I read, it was saying that basically... that humans are basically bad with numbers,
mm-hmm.
And a way to become better with numbers is, so this is basically what I'm saying, is that, like, a way to become better with numbers is to lie
mm-hmm.
within statistics.
Yeah.
Because within, like, human error or, and just, like, data collection error, which also
right.
relates to, human error,
mm-hmm.
those can automatically change your statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So just, like, watching out for those things.
Yeah.
And understanding, like, when you are lying and marking it down so that if you do get questioned about it when you're presenting about a statistic or talking about a statistic,
yeah.
you can automatically know how to switch it up and be like, oh, well, this also can mean this,
right.
and this also can mean that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's basically just, like, what my article was kind of talking more about
mm-hmm.
is, like, getting around the lying, and
yeah.
when you get caught lying, how do you still jump around
yeah,
that situation?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
really all I have.
I think All right, I think that's it for chapter 9. Mm-hmm. We'll head right into chapter 10. This was a really interesting article for me because of, like, all the... This is kind of basically... I thought this was more of a, like, relatable article just because it kind of, like, addresses the reader and it kind of, like, brings up, like, real-life situations. Ray actually had a really interesting point about arguing, like, an opinion with a fact. You want to
go
into that?
Yeah, where are my notes? They're on here somewhere. There they are. All right, come on.
That also went with the question, like, how does he actually know?
Yeah.
I said I often feel hesitant to argue back a fact with an opinion.
Yeah.
Just because it kind of stumbles your mind.
Yeah.
When you hear such large numbers
of figures,
et cetera.
Right, and who knows statistics like that off the top of their head, and who can really argue?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, with that. I mean, even if the person is wrong. So, I mean, I think that's, like, a real-life example and, like, pretty relatable.
Yeah. But, I mean, to go with that, to take a quote from the book, it said, not all statistical information that you may come upon can be tested with the sureness of chemical analysis or of what goes on in an assayer's laboratory. So I went, you know, and just assumed that not everything you hear is true then. It's like, you know, the saying that, well, not everything on the internet you read is true.
Yeah.
So I think we should kind of take that and apply that to other facets of our lives.
Be cautious.
One real world example I had with one of the questions that came up in chapter 2 when you're thinking about using statistics and lying is, the question was, who says so? And yesterday, I was with my SAT freshman history class with Ms. Jonas, and I overheard the girls talking about Pepsi versus Coke. And one of the girls had said, Beyonce represents Pepsi, and she does, like, all these Pepsi commercials. And then Taylor Swift does all these Coke commercials and stuff about Coca-Cola and all that. So they were basically saying, like, more people are going to go for a Pepsi product because Beyonce is on it. So, like, the question of, like, who says so, if Beyonce is the face of Pepsi, she's the person saying, go buy Pepsi.
Yeah,
if
but
Taylor
I just,
Swift
it's just,
is the face of Coca-Cola, she's the one saying, go buy Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Which one do you think are going
to
go
for? It just doesn't make sense to me because there's so much prejudice when it comes to race and statistics. And people often choose a female Caucasian over a female African American when it comes to advertisements and what they find appealing. Except when, you know, you put Beyonce on the cover because everyone thinks that she's amazing, or most people think that she's really amazing and she can do so many things. So I think that the only way to kind of break the barrier for certain things is to have a base, and Beyonce obviously has a base and can top Taylor Swift any day.
Then that makes you ask, like, well, does Beyonce really drink Pepsi?
Right. I mean,
does Taylor Swift really drink Coke?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
But the other questions that were...
do they actually eat real food?
The other questions that were within chapter 10 was, like, you know, is that statistic true? Which kind of goes back to what Ray was saying was, does true really mean it's factual, or does true mean that it can be opinionated as well?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing that I also thought about. Then there was the question of, did somebody change the subject? Did some of the subject change?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that also could relate to the small sampling. Because if you start one way, you start with, like, this really big thing, and then the subject has to change because either, you know, your data doesn't fit with what you were trying to actually prove to help your company. Did it make sense? That's a good question.
Yeah.
Do the stats make sense?
I mean, I just think it's ironic because there's so many comparisons that are missing. And they're there's so many comparisons that are missing, and then it goes to, like, mention these certain stats, and I just think it's ironic that they're, you know, saying that, oh, well, most statistics that you read aren't exactly, you know, what they say they are, and then they're mentioning all these stats, so I really don't know what to believe.
Yeah.
I guess, like, my lingering question is, like, when do you, what
key, I think one thing that I wanted to learn through this book that I didn't are, like, what key things make you, like, automatically know you need to look into that
statistic. I think it's, I think you're
that,
right.
I think, like, that's what I was expecting.
Because otherwise, we can't, like, walk through a grocery store and, like, be looking at every statistics on, like, you know, on every product, like, being wary of all that. So, like, there should be some signs, at least, you know,
but
some
it did do a good job of, like, giving examples of, like, how you can buy through statistics. I just wish it would have told
me. I guess just be wary. I mean, you know. One thing to be paranoid, I guess it's another thing to be cautious, but you know, I can't spend all my life, you know, trying to like decipher certain, you know, statistics. But you know,
I think there's a suspension of common sense when it comes to statistics. And it really kind of proves how much people are blinded by things that are flashy and things that they don't understand, because most people are just too lazy to do the research themselves, so they have no choice but to believe what they see. And they go by, word of mouth. And so back to a page in chapter 10, on 117 specifically, it says a back to the farm movement was discerned when a census showed 500,000 more farms in the U.S. than 5 years earlier, but the two counts were not talking about the same thing. The definition of farm is used by the Bureau of the Census and so on and so forth, and it goes on to use these really large numbers. And I'm over here saying one thing, and I'm reading this paragraph. I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then I go back and I write this thing, this opinion, and I'm like, wait, but that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Was the final wrap up. Analyzing of how
I enjoy our little podcast. I mean, mind our fans. We're really popular here.
I just hope you walk away with, you know, despite the mathematical base of statistics, it's as much of an art as it is a science.
Yes, it definitely is.
Yeah.
All right, well.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Peace.